This is disc number 18.
Richard thought about all the gifted prophets, devoted to their calling, who had worked all of their lives to contribute to this great body of work that was now withering and dying. He thought about the statue he himself had worked so hard to create and how it made him feel when it was destroyed. He thought, too, that it might simply be the concept of death itself in any form that was so dismal because it reminded him of his own mortality and of Kalin's mortality. He also thought that it might be the best thing that could happen. After all, if people no longer believed that prophecy had foreordained what would become of them, then maybe they would realize that they had to think for themselves and decide what was in their own best interest. Maybe, if unchained from a deterministic mindset, people would realize that it was they themselves who actually controlled their own destiny. If people comprehended what was really at stake, maybe they would come to realize the value of reason in the choices they made instead of mindlessly just waiting for what was to happen. "From what Anne and I have discovered," Nathan said into the still, stale air of the library, "the branch of prophecy that is vanishing is that which refers to times roughly since Richard was born. That, of course, makes the most sense because temporal souls nourish the active, living tissue of prophecy upon which this prophecy worm would feed. But I was able to determine that it hasn't all simply vanished yet." Zed nodded.
"It's dying back, but from the root. So, some of it is still alive. I found pockets of it alive and well."
"That's right. Especially the portions from the present on into the future. As you suggest, it seems that the scourge has attacked the core of these branches, which began 2 or 3 decades back, and so far have not extensively eaten their way into future events. That leaves sections of this prophetic branch, the branch involving you, that are still alive," the prophet said as he leaned on his hands toward Richard. "But once it dies, we will then lose even those prophecies, along with the memory of how profoundly important they are." Richard glanced from Nathan's grim expression to Anne's equally serious face. He knew they had arrived at last at the heart of their purpose. "That is why we've come looking for you, Richard Rawl," Anne said with grave intonation, "before it's too late. We have come about prophecy that so far is still alive and has warned us of the most serious crisis to face us since the Great War." Richard frowned, already unhappy that prophecy once again seemed about to cause him trouble. "What prophecy?" Nathan pulled a small book out of a pocket and flipped it open. As he held it in both hands, he fixed Richard with a steady gaze to make sure he looked like he was going to listen carefully. When Nathan was at last sure he had everyone's attention, he began. "In the year of the cicadas, when the champion of sacrifice and suffering, under the banner of both mankind and the light," he glanced up from under his bushy eyebrows, "that would be Emperor Jigang, finally splits his swarm. Thus shall be the sign that the prophecy has been awakened and the final and deciding battle is upon us. Be cautioned, for all true forks and their derivatives are tangled in this mantic root. Only one trunk branches from this conjoined primal origin. If Wergrissa Ostraka does not lead this final battle, then the world already standing at the brink of darkness will fall under that terrible shadow."
"Dear spirits," Zed whispered, "Wergrissa Ostraka is a cardinal link to a prophecy founding a principal fork. Conjoining it with this prophecy establishes a conjugate bifurcation."
Nathan arched an eyebrow. "Exactly." Richard didn't fully understand what Zed had said, but he caught the drift, and he didn't need them to tell him who Wergrissa Ostraka, the bringer of death, was. It was him. "Jigang has split his forces," Anne said with quiet power as she fixed Richard in her steady gaze. "He brought his army up near to Adendril, hoping to finish it, but the Daharan forces, along with the people of the city, made use of winter to escape over the passes to Dahara and out of Jagang's clutches.
I know, Richard said. That escape over the passes in winter was by Kaelin's orders. She's the one who told me about it.
Kara looked up in surprise, apparently intending to dispute his account, but after a glance at Nikki, she decided to remain silent, at least for the moment.
At any rate, Anne said, sounding annoyed by the interruption, Jagang, unable to effectively use his vastly superior numbers to break through those heavily defended, very narrow passes, has finally decided to split his forces. Leaving an army to watch the passes, the Emperor himself took the main element of his army south, headed all the way back down through the Midlands to skirt around the barrier of mountains, and then hook around and make his way up into Dahara. Our forces are headed south, down through Dahara, to meet them. That was why, when we were able to get a message from Verna about the condition of the Books of Prophecy at the People's Palace in Dahara, she was able to ride south ahead of our army and go look them over herself.
This is the year that the cicadas are returning, Nikki said, sounding alarmed. I've seen them.
That's right, Nathan said, still leaned forward on both hands. That means the chronology is now fixed. The prophecies have all made their connections and have tumbled into place. Events are marked.
In turn, he met the gaze of everyone in the room.
The end is upon us.
Zed let out a low whistle.
More importantly, Anne said in an authoritative tone, it means that it is time for Lord Rawl to join the Daharan forces and lead them in the final battle. Without you there, Richard, prophecy is quite clear. All will be lost. We have come to escort you to your forces, to help ensure that you make it. We dare not risk delay. We must leave at once.
For the first time since they started talking about prophecy, Richard's knees felt weak.
But I can't, he said. I have to find Kaelin.
It sounded to him like a plea into a gale. Anne took a deep breath, as if to bite her tongue while she searched for some urgently needed patience, or maybe words that would persuade him and finally settle the matter once and for all. The two moored Sith shared a look. Zed pressed his thin lips tight while he considered. In frustration, Nathan tossed the book he was holding on the table and wiped his hand across his face as he planted his left fist on a hip. Richard didn't know what he could say to them all that would have any chance of making them understand that something profoundly serious was wrong in the world, and Kaelin was only a piece of the puzzle, by far the most important piece, but still a part of something much larger. Ever since the morning when she had disappeared, he had argued himself sick about the urgent need to find her, and it never seemed to do any good at convincing anyone that he knew what he was talking about. He had no interest in yet again wasting his energy on the same fruitless explanations.
You what?
Anne said, her displeasure bubbling up to the surface like dross in a cauldron. At that moment, she was very much again the prelate, a squat woman who somehow managed to seem towering.
I have to find Kaelin, Richard repeated. I don't know what you're talking about. We simply don't have time for any of this nonsense.
Anne had dismissed his wants, interests, and needs out of hand, to say nothing of what he believed were his rational and important reasons.
We have come to see to it that you get to the Daharan army immediately. Everyone is waiting on you. Everyone is depending on you. The time has come when you must lead our forces in the final battle that is now rapidly descending upon us.
I can't, Richard said in a quiet but firm voice.
Prophecy demands it,
Anne shouted. Richard realized that Anne had changed. Everyone had changed in little ways since Kaelin had disappeared, but Anne had changed in more overt ways. The last time she had come, with the very same purpose, to demand that Richard go with her, to lead the war, Kaelin had thrown Anne's journey book into a fire, telling the former prelate that prophecy was not driving events, but rather Anne was, by trying to make people follow prophecy,
in an effort to make it come true that she was acting as prophecy's enforcer. Caelan had shown Anne how she herself, as the prelate, by being prophecy's handmaiden, might very well have actually been the one who'd brought the world to the brink of cataclysm. Because of Caelan's words, Anne had done some deep soul-searching that had eventually helped make her more rational and more understanding of how Richard was the one who had to choose to do what was right. Now, with the memory of Caelan gone, everything that had happened with Caelan was also wiped away. Anne, like everyone else, had reverted to the disposition she'd shown before Caelan's influence. It made Richard's head hurt sometimes, just trying to recall exactly what Caelan had done with everyone, that they wouldn't now remember, so that he could take that into account when he dealt with them. With some people, like Shota, it had actually in some ways helped him. Shota, for instance, because of losing her memory of Caelan, hadn't recalled that she told Richard that if he ever returned to Agadin Reach, she would kill him. With other people, like Anne, it was proving to make matters much more difficult. "Caelan threw your journey book in a fire," he told her. "She was fed up with you trying to control my life, as am I." Anne frowned. "I accidentally dropped my journey book into the fire myself." Richard sighed. "I see." He didn't want to argue because he knew it would do no good. No one in the room believed him. Kara would do whatever he wanted her to do, but she didn't believe him. Nikki didn't believe him, but wanted him to act as he believed he must. Nikki was the one who had actually given him the most encouragement he had gotten since Caelan had disappeared. "Richard," Nathan said in a gentler, more benevolent voice, "this is not some simple little thing. You have been born to prophecy. The world stands at the brink of a great dark age. You hold the key to preventing a slide into that long, terrible night. You are the one prophecy says can save our cause, the cause you yourself believe in. You must do your duty. You can't let us down." Richard was sick and tired of being driven by events. He was at his wit's end with not understanding what was going on, with always feeling like he was one step behind the rest of the world and two steps behind whatever had happened to Caelan. He was getting angry that everyone was telling him what to do, and no one was interested in what was of paramount importance to him. They didn't even want to let him decide his own fate. They thought prophecy had already decided for him. It had not. He needed to find out the truth of what had happened to Caelan. He needed to find Caelan, period. He was fed up with wasting time on what prophecy, along with any number of people, thought he ought to be doing. Anyone who was not helping him was in reality holding him back from something vitally important. "I have no responsibility to live up to what anyone else expects of me," he said to Anne as he picked up the small book Nathan had brought with him. Anne and Nathan stared in surprise. He felt Nikki's reassuring hand on the small of his back. She may not believe in his memory of Caelan, but at least she had helped him see that he had to be true to his principles. She wouldn't allow him to lose by default. She had been a valued friend when he needed one the most. The only other person he knew who would stand by him in that way, stand up to him in that way, was Caelan. He thumbed past all the blank pages in the book Nathan had brought. Richard was curious to see if there was more that might change the picture, if they were only telling him what they wanted him to believe. He also would like to find something, anything, that would help him understand what was going on. And something was going on. Zed's explanation of the prophecy worm sounded airtight, but something about it bothered Richard. It explained the missing text in the books of prophecy in a way that suited what these people wanted to believe. It was too convenient, and worse, it was too much of a coincidence. Coincidence always made Richard suspicious. Nikki had a good point as well. It seemed just a little too convenient that the body buried down at the Confessor's Palace would have a ribbon with Caelan's name embroidered on it, just in case there was any doubt should someone dig up the body. After blank page upon blank page, Richard found the writing. It was exactly as Nathan had read it. "In the year of the cicadas, when the champion of sacrifice and suffering under the banner of both mankind and the light finally splits his swarm. Thus shall be the sign that prophecy has been awakened and the final and deciding battle is upon us. Be cautioned, for all true forks and their derivatives are tangled in this mantic root. Only one trunk branches from this conjoined primal origin. If Fuergrissa Ostraca does not lead this final battle, then the world already standing at the brink of darkness will fall under that terrible shadow. There were several things about the passage that puzzled Richard. For one thing, the reference to cicadas. It seemed a lowly creature to be worthy of prophetic mention, to say nothing of such a central role in the purportedly most important prophecy in 3,000 years. He supposed that it could make sense that it was a key that helped set the chronology, but from what others had told him, prophecy never went out of its way to set chronology, making it one of prophecy's most difficult issues. It also troubled him that this prophecy, so distant in so many ways from the other he had read at the Palace of the Prophets, would also refer to him in High Dahiran as Fuergrissa Ostraca. He supposed that it could be, as Zed had suggested, that such a linkage meant it was important. But the link to the prophecy Richard had seen at the Palace of the Prophets with the reference to Fuergrissa Ostraca was strongly connected to something else, the Boxes of Ordin. In the old prophecy that named Richard the Bringer of Death, the word death meant three different things depending on how it was used. The Bringer of the Underworld, the World of the Dead, the Bringer of Spirits, Spirits of the Dead, and the Bringer of Death, meaning to kill. Each meaning was different, but all three were intended. The second meaning had to do with how he used the Sword of Truth, and the third simply that he'd had to kill people. But the first meaning involved the Boxes of Ordin. He supposed that in the context of the prophecy at hand, the third meaning seemed the obvious, that he had to lead the army and kill the enemy. So calling him Fuergrissa Ostraca did make sense. Yet again, things seemed awfully convenient. All the convenient explanations and coincidences were making Richard more than just a little suspicious. With Kalin's disappearance involved, he felt that there had to be more to what was going on. He turned to the page ahead of the passage, and then the one preceding it, checking. They were blank. "I have a problem with this," he said, looking up at all the eyes watching him. "And what would that be?" Anne asked as she folded her arms. She used the same tone of voice she would have if she'd been talking to an inexperienced, untrained, ignorant boy freshly brought to the Palace of the Prophets to be trained in the use of his gift. "Well, there's nothing around it," he said. "It's all blank." Nathan covered his face with a hand while Anne threw her arms in the air in a gesture of baffled outrage. "Of course not! They've vanished! Along with a great deal more. That's what we've just been talking about. That's why this one is so important." "But without knowing the context, you can't really say that this one is important, now can you? To understand any information, one must know the context." Contrary to Anne and Nathan's agitation, Zed smiled to himself at lessons taught long ago and remembered. Nathan looked up. "What does that have to do with this prophecy?" "Well, for all we know, there might have been mitigating text right before this, or something right after that went on to dismiss this. With the copy missing, how are we to know? This prophecy could have been superseded by just about anything." Zed smiled. "The boy has a point." "He's not a boy," Anne growled. "He's a man. And the Lord Rawl, the head of the Dahiran Empire that he himself pulled together to fight the Imperial Order, and he's supposed to lead those forces. All of our lives depend on him doing so." As Richard flipped back through the book, he saw writing that he hadn't seen the first time. He paged back to it. "Here's something else that didn't vanish," he said. "What?" Nathan asked with incredulity as he twisted around to look. "There was nothing else, I'm sure of it. Right here," Richard said, tapping a finger on the words. It says, "Here we come." What could that mean? And why did it not vanish?
"Here we come."
Nathan's face distorted in a look of confusion.
"I never saw that before."
Richard turned back more pages. "Look, here it is again. Same thing. Here we come."
"I could have missed it once, perhaps," Nathan said. "But there is no way I could have missed a second one. You must be wrong."
"No, look," Richard said, turning the book to show the prophet. He went backward through the book, turning blank pages until he came to writing. "Here it is again, a whole page of the same thing written over and over." Nathan's jaw hung in speechless astonishment. Nikki peered over Richard's shoulder. Zed rushed around next to him to see the writing in the book. Even the two moored Sith came to have a look. Richard turned a page forward to what a moment before had been blank. There, down the page, was the same sentence written over and over and over. "Here we come."
"I watched you turning it back."
Nikki's silken voice carried a clear undertone of disquiet.
"I know that page was blank an instant ago."
Goosebumps prickled up Richard's arms. The hair at the nape of his neck lifted. He looked up and saw something dark coalescing out of the deep shadows beneath the beam of sunlight coming from the high window at the end of the room. Too late, he remembered Shota's warning, not to read prophecy, that if he did, the blood beast would be able to find him. He reached for his sword. His sword wasn't there. Chapter 53. With a wail that sounded like the condemned souls of a thousand sinners, tumbling angles and swirls and streaks of darkness materialized out of the darkness itself, like shadows coming to life. As the tables at the far end of the room were violently upended, the dark tangle exploded through them. Splinters of wood of every size flew through the air. Tables shattered in succession as the beast born of a clutch of shadows came raging across the room toward Richard. The sound of popping and splintering wood boomed through the dusty air of the library. Kara and Rika both sprang in front of Richard, each with her Ajeel in her fist. He knew all too well what would happen should they encounter the beast. The thought of Kara being hurt like that again ignited his rage. Before they could charge toward the dark mass smashing through the heavy library tables, he snatched them both by their long blonde braids and with a roar of anger tossed them back.
"Don't get in its way!"
he yelled at both moored Sith. Anne and Nathan both cast their arms toward the thing, unleashing magic that made the room shimmer as if seen through the waves of heat over a roaring fire. Richard knew that they were compressing the very air itself in an attempt to drive back the attack. Their efforts had no effect on the knot of shadows that rolled and twisted through solid wood as it came across the room. They all backed away, trying to keep distance between them and the threat. Richard ducked as a long board, the entire edge of one of the shattered tables, whipped past his head and smashed against a post. One of the lamps broke open, sending flaming oil splashing across the ancient carpets, setting them ablaze. Gray smoke billowed up behind them as they faced the beast charging for Richard. Zed unleashed a fiery bolt of lightning that passed right through the center of the dark mass of disorder, as if it were not even there, only to hit the bookshelves against the far wall. Books and flaming paper flew up into the air. Great clouds of dust and smoke boiled up as the room filled with the sound of the cacophonous blast. Terrible wails and keening, like the howls of the doomed, through an open doorway down into the depths of the underworld, came from the beast as it came ever onward, crashing through the thick mahogany posts. Lamps spun through the air as if they were flung aside, their silver reflectors casting flickering light around the room and creating shadows that gathered into the beast as it grew more dense and darker yet. Magic being hastily conjured by Anne and Nathan wasn't visible to Richard, but it seemed to pass right through the beast, as if it were made of nothing more than it appeared. Shadows all jumbled together, and yet the knot of darkness crashed through solid wooden tables and posts, splintering them as the thing advanced across the room, Twisting beams squealed and boards shrieked under the stress as another post snapped. The edge of the balcony sagged, then dropped several feet before hanging drunkenly. Another post exploded as it was pushed past its capacity to bend by the onward rush of the dark menace. The edge of the balcony dropped several more feet. Bookshelves teetered on the tilting floor and then toppled, sending an avalanche of books plunging down into the main room. Amidst all the confusion, destruction, and noise, as he backed across the room watching the approaching menace, trying to think of how to counter it, Richard found his shirt grabbed at the shoulder with surprising strength. Nikki rammed him through the open doorway. Tom, standing guard in the hallway, snatched Richard's other arm and helped pull him out of the library as Kara and Rika followed, guarding his retreat. In the room, the beast continued onward, smashing anything in its way as it turned toward the doorway, toward Richard. Anne, Nathan, and Zed all summoned forces Richard couldn't even see, but he could sense them by the hum in the air and the radiating waves of a queasy feeling it gave him in the pit of his stomach. He could feel the air being buffeted as magic was conjured and cast. None of it did any good. They might as well have been attacking shadows. Nikki turned back to the room from the doorway and lifted a fist toward the snarl of shadows tumbling toward her. The sudden explosion made everyone wince and duck as she unleashed a bolt of power that was both blindingly bright and icy dark, laced together into one terrible blast. The discharge of thundering power rocked the keep, shaking the floor and rising dust from every crack and corner. The twisting rope of destruction exploded through the beast, spraying apart. Showers of sparks rained down as bookshelves flew asunder. Wood, debris, and hundreds of books along with sheaves of paper were blasted into the air, leaving fluttering pages to drift through the pandemonium. It looked like a blizzard of paper had been turned loose in the room. The deafening discharge of power from Nikki that rocked the keep also sliced right through the stone walls like flaming pitch through paper. Through the jagged slashes cut in solid stone, ribbons of dusty bluish sunlight suddenly penetrated into the room. The contrast of harsh light against the otherwise dark room made it all the harder to see the murky collection of shade and shadow as it moved through the confusion of destruction. Everyone covered their ears as the terrible wail that sounded like lost souls increased to a terrifying pitch, as if the power Nikki had set upon it had reached down into the underworld to sear them in their dark sanctuary. While it didn't look to have done much to stop the shadowy beast, it did seem to get its attention. Nothing else had. Nikki ran out through the door and shoved Richard, starting him moving down the hallway. He was reluctant to leave Zed to such a threat, but Richard knew that the thing was after him and not his grandfather. Zed would be safer if Richard ran. He didn't think, though, that running was necessarily the solution to his safety. "Stay out of its way," Richard told Tom. "It will rip you to shreds. That goes for you too as well," he said to Kara and Rika as they shepherded him down the hall. "We understand, Lord Rawl," Kara said. "How do we kill it?" Tom asked as they ran sideways down the hall, keeping a wary eye toward the library. "You can't," Nikki answered. "It's already dead." "Oh, great," he muttered as he turned back to help Nikki, Kara, and Rika make sure that Richard kept moving. Richard didn't really think that he needed any physical encouragement. The wails of the dead were enough to urge him to run. Flashes of light, along with angry shrieks, came from the doorway as those in the room still fought to destroy or at least contain what looked like nothing so much as living shadows. Richard knew that they were wasting their time. It was made in part with subtractive magic, and they had no weapon against that. The thing had already proven that much to them, but they were probably trying to distract it so as to give Richard time to get away. So far, it hadn't proven itself susceptible to such tactics. Shota had told him as much. At an intersection, Richard took the paneled hall to the right. The rest of them followed. At intervals, they passed open areas with chairs and couches and dark lamps. Such spots must have once hosted warm conversation and companionship. as they turned and ran down a wider corridor with tan-troweled plaster walls and golden oak floors. A wall ahead exploded. Dust and debris billowed toward them. Richard slid to a stop on the polished wood floor and reversed his direction as the jumble of shadows emerged from the white cloud of dust. Everyone else had previously pushed him on ahead, so that now, having had to turn around, he was at the rear as the beast rapidly closed the distance. The dark snarl looked like it had collected yet more random shadows along the way, small angled shadows, broad leafy shade, inky dark corners, dark haze of dusk, and crumbled them all together like wadding up paper. The way the shadows folded back on themselves made swirling black shapes that constantly eddied over and under and through one another. It was dizzying to watch, even for the brief glimpses he took as he ran. And yet, it was so insubstantial that when he glanced over his shoulder, he could see light from windows far off down the hall right through the thing. Even so, as they raced around corners, the beast would sometimes go wide and graze the walls. And when it did, it ripped apart the wood or plaster or stone as easily as a bull going through bramble. Richard had no idea how to fight a cluster of crumbled shadows that could tear through solid stone without even slowing. He recalled Victor's men in the woods, so violently ripped to shreds in mere moments. He wondered if this was the thing that had slashed through them. If this was the fate they faced that terrible morning when the blood beast came looking for Richard. Two wizards and two sorceresses had now tried to stop Jagang's conjured beast without any practical effect. And Nikki was more than a mere sorceress. She had been taught the sinister art of how to use subtractive magic in exchange for dark oaths that Richard feared to think about. Even that hadn't stopped the beast, although it did seem to get a reaction. Nikki stopped and turned to the dusky collection of shadows careening down the paneled oak halls behind them. She looked like she intended to make a stand. As he caught up with her, Richard, without slowing, planted his shoulder into her middle, knocking the wind from her as he lifted her clear of the floor, carrying her over his shoulder like a sack of grain as he ran. The halls all around lit in a blinding flash of white light as Nikki, having quickly recovered her breath, cast magic behind, even as she was being carted down the hall. The floor shook, nearly knocking Richard from his feet as he ran. Blackness, like the flash of light, caught them and swept past for an instant as Nikki unleashed terrible power at the thing chasing them. By the haunting keening that echoed through the halls, Richard thought that Nikki's effort must have done something. She seized his shirt in both fists as she squirmed.
"Let me down, Richard! Let me run myself! I'm only slowing you down and it's catching up with us! Hurry!"
Richard immediately spun her around in his right arm so that she would be facing the right way. As he dropped her to the ground, he kept his arm around her waist until he was sure she had her balance and was up to speed with the rest of them. With Nikki beside him and Tom, Kara, and Rika right in front of him, they all raced down halls without knowing where they were going. They switched randomly from right turns to left, going past some intersections while taking others. He could hear the beast crashing after them. Sometimes it followed down the halls and corridors, sometimes when they went around a corner, it clipped through the walls, trying to close the distance, trying to get to him. Stone, mortar, and wood seemed to make no difference to the thing as it broke through each with equal ease. He knew that a thing conjured by Sisters of the Dark and tied to the underworld would have abilities that no ordinary creature would possess, so he had no idea what the limits of it might be. As he ran, he yelled to the two moored Sith and Tom,
"You three go straight! Try to get the thing to follow you!"
They looked back as they ran and nodded to his orders.
"That thing isn't going to follow them,"
Nikki said in a low voice as she leaned toward him as best she could at a full run.
"I know. I have an idea. Stay with me. I'm going to take these stairs up ahead."
At a stairwell, as the three in front shot past it, Richard hooked a hand on the black stone sphere atop the granite newel post, spinning himself around it and to the right. Nikki did the same, and they both shot down the stairs at full speed. The beast cut the corner, crashing through the post, sending granite fragments ricocheting off the walls, and the sphere bouncing down the hall. Kara, Rika, and Tom, having already passed the stairs, slid to a stop on the polished marble floor. They were trapped above the beast. They immediately followed it down the stairs. Richard and Nikki bounded down the steps, three or four at a time. He could hear the otherworldly howl of the thing right behind him. It felt as if it were touching the hair at the back of his neck. It was that close. At the bottom of the stairs, Richard cut to the right, following a stone passageway. The beast went wide, crashing into a tan, polished marble wall. The stone slab shattered with a loud bang, but the beast rushed onward. At the first stairwell Richard came to, he raced down it, then took the second and third flight down as well to the bottom. The broad hallway running straight off from the stairs had carpets at regular intervals, making it more difficult to keep their footing. The walls had beaded wainscoting beneath smooth plaster. Brackets spaced down the passageway, centered above each carpet, held what looked like glass globes that brightened as Richard raced toward each one in turn. He ran as fast as he could, Nikki at his side, the shadows tumbling onward like death itself right on their heels. At spiral iron stairs, Richard jumped side saddle onto the railing and slid at breakneck speed in a corkscrew course down into the darkness. Right with him, Nikki threw one arm around his neck for balance and did the same. Together, they plummeted downward, gaining some precious distance on their pursuer. At the bottom, the railings spilled them out onto a cold tiled floor. They both tumbled across the smooth green tiles and slid to a sprawling stop. Richard scrambled to his feet and snatched one of the glowing spheres from a bracket. "Come on, hurry," he said as Nikki did the same. They raced through endless rooms and passageways, taking as wild a route as he could in an effort to shake their hunter. Occasionally, they gained a precious few paces. At other times, especially in the halls, the thing regained the distance and inched ever closer. Some of the rooms were cozy paneled suites. The beast seemed to suck the shadows right out of the cold, dark fireplaces as it passed them. The globes they carried cast a warm glow across intricately woven carpets and richly upholstered chairs. Bookcases held leather volumes. Richard accidentally knocked over a bookstand, but kept his balance and kept running. After charging down yet more flights of stairs, some broad with landings and others nothing more than narrow shafts that seemed bottomless, the rooms began to become less grand. Some of the halls were tiled on all sides with odd patterns. One of the chambers was immense and empty, with fat, round stone pillars spaced evenly throughout. The lights they carried were not enough to penetrate the farthest reaches. Occasionally, the passages were little more than shafts, chiseled through solid rock. Other rooms and halls were protected with shields that Richard deliberately charged through. He didn't want Kara, Rika, and Tom coming near the thing chasing him. He didn't want them meeting the same fate as Victor's men. He knew that Kara would be furious at him when she found herself blocked by shields. He hoped he lived to hear her lecture. They emerged from what appeared as they'd run through it to be a storage room for construction material, with burlap bags and stones stacked to each side. Richard recognized the material from his time in Alterang, at forced labor working on Emperor Jagang's palace. Now Jagang's beast was hunting him down. They emerged on the far side of the storage room into a long corridor with a slate floor. The smooth stone block walls rose uninterrupted to a lofty ceiling that had to be at least 150 feet overhead, creating a narrow, towering vertical slash through the interior of the keep. Down at the bottom of that soaring passageway, Richard felt like an ant. He immediately cut to the right down the immense corridor. The booming drumbeat of their boots echoed all around him as he ran with all his strength. He soon had to slow a bit for Nikki. They were both near the end of their endurance. The wail of 1,000 dead souls tumbled ever onward, never seeming to tire. As he ran, Richard couldn't even see the end of the tall passageway disappearing into the distance. That this was just one corridor of many gave him a profound sense of the enormity of the keep. Arriving at an intersecting passage to the left, Richard turned and ran down it, a short distance to where they encountered an iron stairwell. Trying to catch his breath, he glanced back and saw the knot of shadows round the corner. Pushing Nicky ahead of him, they bounded down the stairs together. At the bottom, they found themselves in a small square room that was little more than an intersection of stone passageways going off in three directions. Richard held the glowing sphere out, taking a quick glance in each passageway. He could see nothing down two of them. In the one to the right, he thought he saw something glimmering. He'd been down in the keep before and had encountered strange places, and one of those places was what he needed now. Together, he and Nicky raced down the passageway. As he'd thought, it wasn't very long, just long enough to take them under the colossal corridor and then a little farther to where it opened into a kind of entry area, with walls covered in small fragments of colored glass, meticulously arranged into elaborate geometric designs. The light from the two glowing spheres glinted off the small glass pieces to send thousands of colored reflections sparkling and shimmering around the room. There was only one other opening, off against a far wall. Richard staggered to a halt. The strange glittering room made his skin crawl with a sensation much like spiderwebs brushing against him. Nicky turned her head away, swiping at her face, as if to get something off her. He knew that such a sensation was part of a broader warning to stay away. Small pillars made of polished gold-flecked stone stood to each side of the distant opening holding up an entablature. The passageway beyond the pillars, not much taller than Richard, appeared to be roughly square and made of simple stone blocks that disappeared off into darkness. It seemed an elaborate and impressive entry for such a plain hallway down in the bowels of the place. Richard hoped he was right about the reason. As they crossed the entry room and approached the opening, the area before the pillars began to give off a faint reddish glow. The air itself began to hum in a very troubling way. Nicky, her hair lifting out from her head as if she were about to be struck by lightning, seized his arm, pulling him back.
"That's a shield!"
"I know," Richard said as he dragged her by her grip on his arm.
"Richard, you can't! It's not just an ordinary shield, not just additive. It's laced with subtractive magic. Such shields are deadly, this one especially so."
He looked back the way they'd come and saw the shadowy beast tumbling down the passageway toward them. "I know, I've been through places like this before." He hoped he was right, that this particular shield was like the ones he'd been through. He needed the kind that he'd encountered before, the kind that guarded the most restricted areas. If it was anything less, or one that was actually more powerful or more restrictive than the ones he'd seen before, then they were going to be in a great deal of trouble. The only way out of the room they were in was back through the passage with the beast that was coming for them, or onward through the shield.
"Let's go, hurry!"
Nikki's chest heaved as she struggled to catch her breath.
"Richard, we can't go through there. That shield will take the flesh right off our bones. I'm telling you, I've done it before. You can command subtractive magic, so you can make it through as well."
He started running toward the passage.
"Besides, if we don't, we're dead anyway. It's our only chance."
With a growl of surrender, she ran along with him through the shower of glittering reflections from the glass mosaics that covered the walls of the room.
"You'd better be right about this."
He grabbed her hand and held it tight, just in case being born with the subtractive side was necessary. Nicky had not been born with it, but had acquired the use of it. He didn't know a great deal about magic, but from what he'd learned, there was a great gulf between being born with it and simply being able to use it. He had helped others without the gift, through shields before. So between her abilities and his hold of her, he figured he could get her through, if that was. He could make it through himself. The air all around them turned as red as a crimson fog. Without pause, Richard charged right through the doorway, pulling Nicky along with him. The sudden avalanche of pressure felt like it would crush them. Nicky gasped. Richard had to force himself against that pressure in order to advance. At the razor edge of the plain along the opening, surrounded by polished stone pillars, heat seared across his flesh. It was so intense that for an instant he thought he'd made a huge mistake, that Nicky had been right, and that the shield would burn the flesh right off his bones. Even as he flinched in reaction to the unexpected burning sensation, his momentum carried him through the doorway. He was somewhat surprised not only to find himself alive and well and not at all harmed, but that the passageway was not at all what it appeared from the other side. When he'd looked through the opening before, it looked like a simple stone block passage. Once past the pillars, it was polished stone that seemed to shimmer with a rippling silver surface that made it appear three-dimensional. A glance back showed the snarl of shadows streaking for the entrance to the opening. Still holding Nikki's hand, Richard backed them farther into the sparkling passageway. He was too exhausted to run anymore. "Here we live or die," he told her as he labored to catch his breath. Chapter 54. The shadow hit the opening with such a resounding thud that Richard thought the passageway they were in would certainly be blown apart. What had been a somewhat cohesive, dark shape exploded apart like glass on granite, shattering into thousands of dark shards. Piercing wails of frightful anguish echoed through the passageway in terrible, heartbreaking finality as light ignited in a blinding crimson flash. At the shielded opening, black fragments of shadows tumbled back through the room that was filled with shimmering, sparkling reflections off the glass mosaics. With what looked like a year's worth of meteor showers all compressed into a single instant, the shadowy fragments burst into bright flares that flew in every direction as they glimmered into nothingness. It was suddenly quiet but for Richard and Nikki's labored breathing. The beast was gone. At least it was gone for the moment. Richard let go of Nikki's hand, and they both flopped down heavily on the floor and slumped back against the iridescent silver wall as they panted in exhaustion.
"You were looking for one of those shields, weren't you?"
Nikki asked as she worked at recovering enough breath to talk. Richard nodded.
"Nothing Zed or Nathan or Ann conjured did anything to stop the beast. What you did at least seemed to have had an effect, even if a small one. That made me think that there must be something that would be able to counter it, maybe not in totality, but at least in the form it presented this time. I knew that the wizards from the time back when this place was built needed to stop anything that didn't belong in here, and the beast, after all, was something from back in those times, something that Jigang had found described in old books. So I figured that those who made the shields here must have had to take such eventualities into account. Since they're made to stop such threats, it takes, at the least, an element of subtractive magic to get through the shields. But because the enemy would have had subtractive powers as well, I think the shields must also somehow read the nature of who is trying to pass through them, perhaps thereby interpreting the potential level of threat. It could even be that as we were chased through the keep and kept going through shields, they somehow gathered information on the nature not only of us, but of the beast as well, so that when we reached these higher threshold shields, they had finally judged it a threat and stopped it. Nikki considered what he'd said as she pulled sweaty strands of blonde hair back off her face. No one really knows a great deal about the gifted back then, but it makes sense that such an ancient threat would be vincible to ancient defenses.
She frowned as if an idea had come to her.
Maybe such shields would even be a way to protect you if it reappears.
Sure, he said. If I want to live down here like a mole... She looked around.
Any idea where we are?
No, he said, letting out an exhausted sigh. But I guess we'd better try to find out. They struggled to their feet and made their way the rest of the distance down the short passageway. At the end, they emerged into a simple room constructed of stone blocks once covered in plaster that was now crumbling. The room was no more than 15 paces long and not nearly as wide, with books on shelves along most of the length of the wall to the left. While it did have some books, it was not a library like so many others he had seen in the keep. For one thing, it was far too small. For another, it was not at all elegant or even nice, but rather stark. At best, it could be called utilitarian. Besides the shelves, the room was only wide enough for a table at the far end beside a passageway leading out the other side. There was a fat candle on the table and a wooden stool under it. The far passageway looked very much like the one they had come in through. When Richard took a look, he saw that it had the same shimmering silver stone walls and another shield that looked just like the one they had come in through at the other end of the room, so that, unlike a number of places in the keep that had shields, there was no way to go around and get into the room by way of another route without such powerful shields. It was through one of the two shields, or not at all.
"With all the dust in here," Nikki said, "it doesn't look like anyone has cleaned in here for thousands of years."
She was right. The room was devoid of color, other than the dirty gray color of the dust that coated everything. The hair at the nape of Richard's neck stood on end as he fully realized why.
"That's because no one has been in here for thousands of years."
"Really?" He gestured to the far passage he'd just inspected. "The only two ways into here are protected with shields that require subtractive magic to cross. Not even Zed, the first wizard himself, has ever been in here. He can't pass subtractive shields."
Nikki brushed her hands together. "Especially these shields. I've dealt with shields most of my life. From what I felt of these, they're deadly. I suspect that without your help, even I might have had some difficulty getting through them the first time."
Richard tilted his head to be able to better read the titles as he perused the books along the shelves. Some had no titles on the spines. Some were in languages he couldn't read. Some looked like they might be journals. Several, though, looked curious. One small book, Gegendross, in High Daharan meant countermeasures. He pulled out another beside it of a similar small size titled Ordenic Theory. As he blew off a thick coating of dust, he realized then that it must have caught his attention because Ordenic reminded him of Orden, as in the boxes of Orden. He wondered if there was any connection.
"Richard, look at this,"
Nikki called to him from the far passage. Richard tossed the book on the table as he made his way into the passageway toward the shield. "What is it?"
"I don't know."
Her voice echoed, and then he saw the crimson glow brighten and finally fade. He realized that she must have gone beyond the shield. Alarmed at first, Richard was hugely relieved that there had been no horrific results. Nikki was an experienced sorceress. He suspected that after having gone through the last shield, she must have known what dangers to look for to tell her if she could pass this one as well. He reasoned that perhaps the first shield, when he had helped her through it, had keyed to her, allowing her to cross shields like it. Pushing on through the plane of pressure and briefly searing heat, he entered a small room beyond with glass mosaics, like the one at the other end of the little reading room. Both rooms had to be a kind of entryway, before the shield to provide warning to anyone coming near, or maybe they were somehow an aid to the shields themselves. Nikki was standing just beyond, at an open iron door, her back to him, her thick fall of blonde hair down around her shoulders. At the railing on the platform beside her, Richard looked out into a round tower room at least 100 feet across. Stairs spiraled up around the inside of the curving outer wall. The tower rose above them for over 200 feet. At irregular intervals, small landings like the one where they stood interrupted the steps wherever there was a doorway. In the gloomy expanse above, shafts of light pierced the darkness. The place smelled of rot. At the bottom of the tower, not too far below the landing where they stood, he saw a walkway with an iron railing that ringed the inside of the tower wall. Rain that could come in the openings above, along with seepage from the mountain itself, collected down in the center of the tower. Insects swarmed above the stagnant, inky water. Others skittered on its surface.
"I know this place,"
Richard said as he peered around, getting his bearings.
"You do?"
He started down the steps.
"Yes, come on."
At the bottom, he followed the iron railing around to a wide platform in the walkway before a spot where a door had once been. The doorway had been blasted apart, and the opening was now perhaps twice its previous size. The jagged edges of the broken stone were blackened in places. In other places, the stone itself had been melted, as if it were no more than candle wax. Twisting streaks on the surface of the stone wall ran off in every direction away from the blasted hole, marking where a kind of lightning had flailed against the wall and burned it. Nikki stared in amazement. What in the world happened here? This room was once sealed away, along with the old world. When I destroyed the barrier to the old world, it blew the seal open. Why? What's in here? The Sliff's Well. The thing you told me about, that those in ancient times used to travel great distances? The thing you've traveled in? That's right, he said as he stepped through the jagged opening that once had been a doorway. The room inside was round, perhaps 60 feet across. Its walls were also scorched in ragged lines as if lightning had gone wild in the place. A circular stone wall about waist high, forming what looked like a huge well, occupied the center of the room. The domed ceiling was nearly as high as the room was wide. There were no windows or other doors. To the far side of the Sliff's Well was a table and a few shelves. That was where Richard had found the remains of the wizard, who had in ancient times been sealed in the room when the barriers that had ended the Great War had been brought to life. Thus trapped, the man had died in the sealed room. He had left behind a journal that the moored Sith Burdeen now had. That journal had in the past, as Richard and Burdeen had translated it, revealed valuable information. Because of the importance of the information they'd gotten from the journal, they had called the man who wrote it, Koloblysin, a high Daharan word meaning strong advisor. Burdeen and Richard had eventually taken to simply referring to the mysterious wizard as Kolo. Nikki held her glowing globe over the side and peered down the well. The smooth walls fell away seemingly forever, the light illuminating the stone for hundreds of feet down before fading into blackness. And you say that you put the Sliff to sleep? Yes, with ease. Richard tapped the insides of the leather-padded silver wristbands he wore against one another. She told me that when she sleeps, as she put it, she goes to be with her soul. She says it's rapture for her to sleep. And you can call her back the same way by using those bands? Well, yes, but just like putting her to sleep, I would need to use my gift to do it, not something I'd be at all eager to do again. I especially wouldn't like to be inside this room with only one door calling the Sliff when the Blood Beast was also called by my gift. Nikki nodded as she saw his point. Do you think the Beast could follow you through the Sliff? Richard thought it over for a moment. I can't say for sure, but I imagine it's possible. But even if it couldn't, it still manages to appear wherever I am. So I'm not sure it would even need to bother with using the Sliff. From what I've learned of its nature, from you and Shota, as well as from experience, I suspect that the Beast is able to travel the underworld. And other people? Nikki asked. Can any of them use this? To travel in the Sliff, you need to have at least some element of both sides of the gift. That made it a problem in the Great War, and that's why they had a wizard always standing guard in this room, and in the end, why they had to seal it off, so the enemy couldn't come through right into the heart of the keep. Now, because of the requirement for an element of both sides of magic, there are few who can use the Sliff. Kara has captured gifted people who have additive magic, and she captured a man who Kaelin said wasn't entirely human, and who happened to have an element of subtractive magic. It was enough so that Kara is able to travel in the Sliff. A confessor's power is ancient, and has an element of subtractive to it. So Kaelin can travel in the Sliff. Those are the only ones I know who could travel in the Sliff, other than Sisters of the Dark. One of my former teachers, Marissa, went through the Sliff after me. You could travel in the Sliff as well. That's about it. Still, it remains a danger if awakened because Jigang could theoretically send any of his Sisters of the Dark through it. What happens if you don't have at least some element of both sides? Nikki asked. If, for example, someone like Zed, a gifted person, had only additive magic, tried to travel. Richard reached over to rest his hand on the pommel of his sword, but his sword wasn't there. It made him sick to expect it, and then realize he'd given it to Shota, to Samuel, actually. He put the constant, haunting worry of it from his mind. Well, traveling takes you great distances, but it still takes some time. It isn't an instant procedure. I think the time varies according to distance, but I know that it takes a number of hours at least.
the slough looks something like living quicksilver. To remain alive within her while she takes you to the place you wish to travel, you must breathe her in, breathe in that silvery liquid. You breathe the slough, that liquid, and it somehow keeps you alive. If you don't have an element of both sides, it doesn't work and you die, simple as that. For a fleeting moment, Richard gave thought to waking the slough to ask if she remembered Kaelin, but the ancient wizards, men of prodigious ability, had created the slough out of a very exclusive and high-priced whore. She had become caught up in a political intrigue that had eventually cost her her life. The nature of that woman was still partly evident in the slough. She never revealed the identity of one of her customers. We'd better get back up there and let Zed know we're all right. Richard's thoughts returned to the immediate problems. Kara is probably fit to be tied by now.
Richard,
Nikki said in a soft voice as he started to leave. He turned back to see her watching him. Yes?
What are you going to do about Anne and Nathan?
He shrugged. Nothing. What do you mean?
I mean, what are you going to do about the things they had to say? What are you going to do about the war? The time has come, and I think you know it. You can't go on chasing after your dream while the rest of the world faces the end of everything good, the end of all their hopes and dreams.
He stared at her a moment. She didn't shy away from his gaze. Like you said, that body down there didn't prove anything.
No, but it certainly does prove one thing, that you were wrong about what we would find there. Digging up the grave failed to prove what you thought it would, at the very least. That begs the question of why. Why it was different than you said it would be. The only possible answer I can think of is that someone put it there with the idea that you would find it. But why? It's been a while since that night down at the grave. Since then you've accomplished nothing. Maybe it's time you thought about the bigger picture. And in the bigger picture, that prophecy makes the stakes pretty clear. I understand the value of one life you love, even if she were real. But to some extent, don't you think you have to balance that one life against the lives of everyone else?
Richard slowly paced off a ways, trailing his fingers along the top of the stone wall around the slough. The last time he had traveled in the slough, he had taken Kaelin to the Mud People so they could be married.
I have to find her.
He looked back at Nikki. I am not the tool of prophecy.
Where will you go? What can you do next? You've been to Shota, and you came here to Zed. No one knows anything about Kaelin or Chainfire or the rest of it. You've exhausted all your ideas, all your options. If not now, then when is the time to finally face reality?
Richard rubbed his fingertips across his brow. As much as he didn't want to admit it, he feared that Nikki was right. What was he going to do? He could think of nowhere else to go, nothing else to do. At least, nothing specific. Not at the moment, anyway. He couldn't imagine what good it would do him to wander around without a plan, without any idea where to look for Kaelin. The room was dead quiet. The slough's well was empty. The slough off somewhere with her soul. He wondered if Kaelin was still alive. He swallowed as he experienced one of those brief but terrifying moments when he wondered if she ever had been. He was so tired of the ever-growing doubts, not just about Kaelin, but about himself. At the same time, he was being crushed under the weight of guilt for not answering the call to lead the Daharan people against the terrible threat to their freedom. He thought often of all the countless good people he didn't even know, who also had loved ones under mortal threat from the coming storm of the Imperial Order. Could he just desert all of them in order to chase around forever looking for Kaelin? Nikki moved closer.
Richard, she said in a soft, silken, sympathetic voice, I know it's hard to say it's over. To say it's over and realize that you have to move on.
Richard broke the gaze first. I can't do that, Nikki. I realize that I can't explain it to anyone's satisfaction, but I just can't do that. I mean, if she got sick and died, then I would be devastated, yet eventually I know I would have to deal with the business of life.
But this is different. It's almost as if I know she's in some dark river somewhere calling for help, and I'm the only one who can hear her, who knows she is in terrible danger of drowning. Richard, do you really think I don't care about all the innocent people under the threat of the Horde coming to slaughter and enslave them? I do care. I can't sleep with worry, and not only worry for Kaelin. Can you even begin to imagine how torn I feel? How would you feel if you were torn between someone you loved and doing what everyone else said was the right thing to do? I wake in a cold sweat in the dead of night, not only seeing Kaelin's face, but the faces of people who will never have a chance at life if Jigang isn't stopped. When people tell me how all those people are depending on me, it breaks my heart. Both because I want to help them and because they think they need me, because they think that I, one man, can be the difference in a war involving millions of people. How dare they put that much responsibility on me? She came closer yet and gently put a hand to the side of his arm, rubbing up and down in a reassuring gesture. Richard, you know that I wouldn't want you to do anything that you thought was wrong, not even when it was to let you believe she was dead, based on what I knew wasn't good evidence, even though I believe that evidence, if for other reasons. I know. But since that night when you dug up the grave, while you've been wandering around thinking about what you can do, I too have been doing a lot of thinking. Richard flicked a small stone fragment from the top of the wall, not wanting to have to look up at her. And what have you come up with? Among other things, as I watched you walk the ramparts, a troublesome idea came to me. I haven't said anything about it yet, partly because I don't know for sure if it could be the answer to what is happening to you, and partly because if it is, then it would be even more trouble than any mere delusion caused by your injury. I don't know if it's really the answer, but I fear that it very well might be. Mostly, though, I haven't said anything because the evidence is gone, so I have no way of proving it, but I think the time has arrived to broach the subject.
Evidence? Richard asked. You said that the evidence is gone?
Nikki nodded. The arrow you were shot with. I fear that this may have all been caused by that arrow, but in a different and far more disturbing way than we've realized.
Richard was taken aback by her grave expression.
What do you mean? Did you see who shot the arrow that hit you? Who held the crossbow?
Richard took a deep breath while staring off as he sifted through the dim snatches of mental images of the morning of the fight. He'd only just awakened after hearing the howl of a wolf. Shadowy tree limbs had appeared to move about in the darkness. Then there had been soldiers all around him. He'd had to fight off men from all sides rushing in at him. He remembered quite vividly the feeling of holding the Sword of Truth, of feeling the wire-wound hilt in his hand, of its power surging through him. He recalled seeing men back in the trees shooting arrows at him. Most had bows, but there had been some with crossbows. That would have been rather typical for such a patrol of Imperial Order troops.
No, I can't say as I recall seeing who shot the bolt that hit me. Why? What is it that you've come up with?
Nikki appraised his eyes for what seemed an eternity. Her ageless eyes sometimes reminded him of others with magic. Anne, the old prelate. Verna, the new prelate. Addy, Shota, and Kaelin.
The barbs on that arrow made it impossible to get it out of you in any ordinary way in time to save your life. I was in a desperate hurry. I never gave any thought to checking the arrow before I used subtractive magic to take it out of existence.
Richard didn't like the direction toward which her worry seemed to be drifting. Check it for what?
A spell. A diabolically simple spell that would be profoundly destructive.
Richard was now sure he didn't like her idea, even though he hadn't heard it yet. What kind of spell?
A glamour spell.
Glamour? Richard frowned. How would that work?
Well, think of it as a love potion.
Richard stared at her in surprise. A love potion?
Yes, after a fashion.
She lightly tapped the fingers of opposite hands together as she reflected on how best to explain it,
A glamour spell would cause you to have a mental vision of a woman. A real woman would be the normal object of the spell. But as I thought about it, I realized that it would work just as well for an imaginary woman. Either way, it would make you fall in love with her. But even that is a rather weak way of describing such a powerful spell. Under a glamour spell, the woman would become an obsession. Such an obsession would be to the exclusion of almost everything else. A glamour spell is a kind of dark secret among sorceresses, usually taught by a gifted mother. Such a spell would be used to make a specific person fixate on the subject of the spell, usually a real individual, the sorceress herself, in most cases. Like I said, it's a kind of love spell. Some gifted women could not resist the lure of using a glamour on men. The spell is so effective that at the Palace of the Prophets it was a very serious matter for one of the sisters to even be suspected of using a glamour. To be caught using a glamour was a grave crime, the moral equivalent to rape. The punishment was severe. The sorceress was at the least banished. But she could just as well be hanged. There have been sisters convicted of such a crime. As I recall, the last one caught at the palace was over 50 years ago. She was a novice, Valdora. The tribunal was split between hanging or banishment. The prelate broke the tie and had the young novice banished. I would expect the Jagang sisters know how to invoke a glamour spell. It wouldn't have been all that hard for one of them to tag a glamour to that arrow, or a number of the arrows that morning. If the arrow didn't kill you, it would spell you. This is no spell, Richard said, his tone turning darker. Nicky ignored not just his tone, but his denial as well. It would explain a great deal. A glamour spell seems absolutely real to the victim. It bends their mind, their thinking, around the subject of the obsession. Richard again raked his fingers back through his hair, trying not to get angry with Nicky. What would be the purpose of doing such a thing? Jagang wants to kill me. You're the one who came and told me that he created a beast to accomplish that task. The spell you're talking about doesn't make any sense. Oh, but it makes all the sense in the world. It would accomplish far more than merely killing you, Richard. Don't you see? It would destroy your credibility. It would leave you alive to destroy your cause yourself. Myself? What do you mean? It would make you obsessed with the subject of the glamour to the exclusion of anything else. It would make people think there was something wrong with you, think you were crazy. It would make people begin to doubt you and therefore your cause. This spell would condemn you to a living death. It would destroy everything that means anything to you. It would give you a mad obsession that you totally believe is something real, but that you can never satisfy. There is good reason why using a glamour spell was a serious crime. In this case, at the same time as you go about trying to find the object of your manufactured memory, you see your cause begin to crumble because those you inspired and who believed in you now start to think that you're crazy. Then maybe the things you've said were crazy as well. Richard imagined that a victim of such a web would not be able to recognize the glamour spell within himself.
This is the end of disc number 18. Please insert disc number 19.